Welcome this evening to an auspicious and important Sunday, certainly in the church calendar. On Tuesday, it'll be 506 years since the Reformation took place. This was the Protestant movement which began to throw off the shackles and repression of Roman Catholicism and to embrace biblical truth. So it's a long time ago, and we're going to do some big leaps this evening. We're going to jump back half a millennia and then two whole millennia, all the way back to Paul. So be prepared for some big biblical historical jumps. So this is Reformation Sunday. Now, it didn't just come out of nowhere when all of this change happened. I have to tell you, there were Christians around, for the whole time up until the early 1500s. And the likes of John Wycliffe was around in the 1360s. He was speaking against the Holy Roman Empire and its teachings even then. And it took about 150 years from him to get to this point where ordinary people, steeped in man-made rules and lies and ignorance about the things of God, were taken back to the Bible as the authoritative, inspired word in all matters about human thought and existence. Now, the two readings I read are actually quite significant and essential understanding for anyone coming to this, whether it's for the first time or the 100th time, because they show us two things. In Romans 1, Paul shows us what is wrong with us. And in Romans 3, he shows us what is so very right about God. What's so wrong with us and what is so right about God. And so it's basically a two-point sermon based around those two thoughts. And so obviously I'm going to start with the first one. What is so wrong with us? Well, I'm going to kind of take you through a little bit of a historical walk to get there. So bear with me if you can, please. I want to start in the UK, first of all. Back in about the 600s AD, monks named like Columba travelled from Ireland to Scotland, to Iona, if you've ever been there, and built a monastery. And from there, another saint called Aidan travelled to Northumbria and established Lindisfarne, if you've been there. It's beautiful. And from there, Bede, the Venerable Bede, lived in Northumbria. Possibly one of the most learned men of his age. He knew Latin and Greek and Hebrew. He was familiar with the literature of ancient Greece and ancient Rome. And it was from men like these who copied out the Gospels by hand that the Bible, the first glimmers of the Bible, began to light up Anglo-Saxon Britain. So that's going back quite a long time, isn't it? However, all that sounds quite positive and good. But at the same time, in some of the key cities of Europe, in Rome, ancient Alexandria, Jerusalem, Constantinople, and Corinth, rather than the light going out, the light was fading fast. A rot was setting in, and it was about which church figure had the most authority. Sam spoke this morning, or he quoted, "Absolute power absolutely corrupts," and I've got the same quote in my sermon. These men were popes, or archbishops, if you like. They weren't quite popes yet. And they were known as patriarchs, and they set about struggling for preeminence amongst themselves. So the biggest fish in the pond began to sort of fight it out. And eventually, the Patriarch of Rome declared himself the successor of the Apostle Peter and became known as Pope. So by about the same time as Columba was going into the UK as a missionary, well, in Rome, the Pope had established himself. And so we see kind of this balance swinging like this, don't we? And this power grab by the Roman Catholic Church, as it was becoming, was huge, and its ripples spread across the whole of Europe for about 450 years. Those great cathedrals that stand so beautifully, don't they? And the universities full of their statues and religious artifacts sprang up in all the key cities, and the church exalted itself for about another 500 years. Nearly 1,000 years this went on. Man is proud, you see. However, God uses unlikely heroes, and the Bible's full of them. And when his time is right, he calls them forth onto the world stage. For example, we didn't do this by any chance at all. For example, the eighth and last son of a sheep farmer in Bethlehem becomes the great King David. A nobody becomes one of the greatest men who ever lived. And Martin Luther was one such man. In schools, we try and teach children about the great worthies across history, people who made the discoveries and invented the inventions and had the big ideas that changed and shaped the world. However, I think the name Martin Luther could result in a lot of blank stares, despite the effect that he had, the ripples he started. This was a man who was a monk himself, and he was used to shape the world we live in many ways. Without the stance he took, we could still be cowering before a false god made of mankind's own ideas. We're going to lightly trace Martin Luther's journey, finding the truth about himself and about the only living God. And within that, we'll explore how Paul and, of course, God's point of view changed and influenced this man and brought him to be saved. So, that's sort of the backdrop, quick historical walk through about 1,000 years. Mankind's problem, then, in all of this. We've already said that man is proud, but man also thinks that they are wise. However, God has something to say about that, does he not? Because when we go to Romans 1, claiming to be wise, they became fools. Verse 22, man's wisdom is not really wisdom at all. It is naturally dark. Human beings think in futile ways. All of our very best ideas have got a downside. Have you ever noticed that? The motor car. It's amazing. A motor car. And yet it pollutes the world in so many ways with fumes and leftover tires and goodness knows what else, doesn't it? Kills people as they cross the road and so on and so on. Nuclear power. It's an amazing thought that we've kind of harnessed the power of the atom. And yet really it terrifies everybody, doesn't it? The idea of a nuclear power station on your doorstep, nobody would want it. Because we all know how horrendous an accident would be. Everything's got a downside. Even the wonderful wind turbines that look so graceful and peaceful, and it's free energy, and it's not really. It all leads to frustration. They all crumble, and everything loses its gloss. Mankind's wisdom doesn't ever really work. Well, the Bible has a simple and clear answer. We become futile because although we knew God, we did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. Now, if humanity is not honoring or thanking God for his wisdom, the implication is that they honor themselves and are very thankful for themselves and their own plans and designs. In effect, humanity begins to worship itself. And in so doing, it actually breaks the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. And there it is. We become our own God before God. The problem with mankind, at its core, deep down at its core, is that we are idol worshippers. We are idol makers, and we worship them. Now, I want to tell you what God thinks about idols. You don't have to turn, but in Isaiah 41, verse 21, God speaks. And he says this, present your case. It's like a court law, a law court, sorry. Present your case, says the Lord. Set forth your arguments, says Jacob's king. Tell us, you idols, what is going to happen? So the idols are in the dock. Tell us what the former things were, so that we may consider them and know their final outcome. Or declare to us the things to come. Tell us what the future holds, so we may know that you are gods. Do something, whether good or bad, so that we may be dismayed and filled with fear. But you are less than nothing, and your works are utterly worthless. Whoever chooses you is detestable. That's what God says about idols. It's quite brutal, isn't it? There's no holds barred there. It's not dressed up so you can't understand it. He puts them in the dock and he judges them. Do something, whether good or bad. He challenges them, doesn't he? Come on then, do something. If you're a god, do something. And then the judgment is pronounced. You are less than nothing. Whoever chooses you is detestable. Now, this is a terrifying thing for us. If you're not a Christian here, I've just said that we are idol makers and idol worshippers by our very nature if we're human beings. And God says, whoever worships them, whoever chooses idols, is detestable. And we are detestable before God. In our sin, God hates sin. Well, thankfully, that isn't the only part of the story. I have more to say on that as we go on. Idols don't have to be a gold idol in a temple either. They don't have to be a thing. They can be political ideas that we elevate to a point of worship. It could be your phone. It could be your looks. But they don't enrich us. They impoverish us. We are left ignorant and subservient to them, desperately trying to earn our own salvation by appeasing these gods. We try and earn favor. See, this letter to the Romans is absolutely correct, saying we worship the creation and not the creator, because of course, if that's true, then, if you go back to Martin Luther, you would end up praying to someone like a statue of Mary, wouldn't you? Paul says they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man. And you would serve a God who you view like a cosmic slot machine, where you put in your good and you expect good things to come out for you. You would view God like a pair of scales. They tilt against us when we do bad, but we can correct them and tilt them towards us if we do something good. You see, if we make a God for ourselves, the God we make is fickle, short-sighted, short-tempered, forgetful, distant, and constantly requires more from us to be kept happy. That's what idolatry looks like. No wonder God detests it. Now, thankfully, about 500 years ago, God stepped into our history here in Britain and in Europe, and the Reformation changed that I've just been describing. Henry VIII was a 26-year-old king, and this monk, Martin Luther, was used mightily to change history. Let me tell you a little bit about him. I've got a question here. Was his problem recognizable to you? Martin Luther was an earnest, diligent, and pious monk. And he plunged himself into prayer and fasting, where he would go without eating for ages. He wouldn't sleep. He would endure bone-chilling cold without a blanket. He would whip himself for what he considered his sins. He later commented in his life, "If anyone could have earned heaven by the life of a monk, it was I." But of course, he couldn't. The seeds of change, however, were in him before he knew it. When he was young, he had a chance to visit the Vatican. And what he found in Rome shocked him. He expected it to be the seat of all that was good and righteous. And he would have been inspired by it. But no. It utterly disillusioned him. The corruption, the dishonesty and the immorality he found everywhere left him bewildered. He began to question what kind of faith it could be that could be held so high and yet be treated so scornfully. By the time he was a professor of biblical studies at the university he was at, he was struggling. His problem was he was forever trying to be as good as possible and found that no matter how hard he tried, his sinful nature kept coming up and coming up and coming up. Now, maybe you try and be good. Maybe you try and be good. I think we're all guilty of it. We all still think in our heads, bizarrely, "Oh, God would be happy that I've done that today." Maybe you don't put it into those words. Maybe it's just a feeling. But we do it. And yet, then we fall. And we're so disappointed in ourselves. We're so angry with ourselves. We're so shamed that we dare go to God to ask for forgiveness sometimes. And we live this life which just goes up, down like this, all the time. Martin Luther became very angry with God. He had to point it somewhere. He began to reach a crisis point. In Romans 1:17, he read this: "The righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. As it is written, the righteous shall live by faith." Now, remember, this self-righteous, earnest, pious young man was not a Christian, as the Bible explains it. And yet, as he read the Bible, his eyes were drawn not to the word faith, but the word righteous. Who, after all, who can live by faith except those who are already righteous? The text was clear. The righteous shall live by faith. But Luther, Martin Luther, could not live by faith because he knew he was not righteous. He knew it. He knew his heart was wrong. He said this: "I hated that word, the righteousness of God, by which I had been taught, according to the custom and use of all teachers, that God is righteous and punishes the unrighteous sinner." You see, he's kind of shaking his fist. "God, don't you see I'm trying so hard? Is that not enough?" But it wasn't enough. It was never going to save him that he was trying hard. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, "Peter, what on earth has a 500-year-old monk from Germany got to do with me in 2023? But I just want you to notice that his own private thoughts may not be so far away from your own. There's things about humans that just never change. You see, Martin Luther hated God, actually, when he got down to it. God, he felt, was cold and condemning of him. God's righteousness was not a thing of beauty and wonder. It was a thing of horror to him in his mind. It was a purity against which he had no defense. And he couldn't stand. You see, God's righteousness, he knew, was going to bring him to an eternity of lostness and punishment. And he would deserve it. He knew that. That's the conviction of a sinner. It's when you know there's nowhere else to go. Now, of course, if that was all Luther had known, then he would have been a desperate, desperate man. But he was focused on only one part of the picture. He hadn't yet realized that the righteousness of God is not just the only isolated part of God's character, a standalone element that sentences you to death. God's rightness also means that he is a God who, by his great grace, holds out mercy. Martin Luther, you see, had made up a view of God for himself, hadn't he? He wasn't in possession of all the facts, but the God of the Bible is always more than you think he is. Always more. You keep discovering it all your Christian life. And many people, if they believe in God at all in some way, usually end up with a God who suits their purposes and view of the world. We're not so far removed from Luther, you see. Many people like to have a God who is merciful and loving, but they refuse to acknowledge his justice. And so their version of God is someone who is soft and woolly and kind of benevolent. This then allows for a God who will probably let you off for good behavior. A God who might tolerate and endorse gay marriage or open marriage or no marriage. A God who will accept quick divorces and state interference in the raise of children. A God who would approve of gender self-identification. A God who might let you off for abortion. A God who is still somehow duty-bound to throw open the gates of heaven to you. Well, there are other people, of course, who have the exact opposite view. They have a God, and in their mind, he's all justice and no mercy. An angry, intolerant, narrow-minded God. No longer in keeping with modern thinking. He's a God you can feel justified in rejecting, saying he's old-fashioned and irrelevant. Well, neither view is the view of the real God. If you can only accept a God because he fits into your view of what you want the world to look like, or because he doesn't fit into the world that you want the world to be like, then what kind of God is that? And here we come to the real question that Martin Luther had to face. What is God really like? This is probably the most fundamental question you can ask. Martin Luther now, as we continue in the sermon, starts to move from despair to hope. If you're not a Christian here this evening, you could be doing the same. He began to sense that his goodness was never good enough. And finally he was directed by a mentor, a kindly older man, directed to just read the Bible for himself. Have you read it? Have you read it? It's amazing, isn't it, how many people who would say, oh, the Bible, that's a lot of rubbish, isn't it? And you say, have you read it? And they go, no. Well, Christians, do we do it enough? Not as a study or out of duty, but just to relish God's voice talking to us. It's in doing this we can see what is so right about God. And it was while Martin Luther studied the Bible that he began to change from what he realized was a God-hater into someone who realized that the true God of the Bible was an abundant, generous, loving God. This is what Isaiah says in chapter 55. And again, it's kind of God speaking to people. Why spend money on what is not bread, and your labor on what does not satisfy? Listen. Listen to me. Eat what is good, and you will delight in the richest of fare. Give ear and come to me. Listen, that you may live. I will make an everlasting covenant with you, my faithful love, promised to David. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call on him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake their ways, and the unrighteous their thoughts. Let them turn to the Lord, and he will have mercy on them, and to our God, for he will freely pardon. Now, the Bible's really talking not really about bread and eating what's good. It's talking about soul food. Okay, things that are really good for you. Well, it's to come to God. You see, to Martin Luther's amazement, maybe to yours, God is someone who wants us to be close to him. He's ready to share everything he has without hesitation. His righteousness is held out to us with an open hand, and it is only when we're dressed in it that we can stand before him without being consumed by it. Without it, we die. Luther said this: "For although the whole world has most carefully sought to understand the nature, mind, and activity of God, it has had no success in this whatsoever. But God himself has revealed and disclosed the deepest profundity of his fatherly heart, his sheer, inexpressible love." Well, he began to see a way through his dilemma. Again, he said, "At last, meditating day and night by the mercy of God, I began to understand that the righteousness of God is that through which the righteous live, by a gift of God, namely faith. Here, I felt as if I were entirely born again and had entered paradise itself." Lovely. Martin Luther finally understood that salvation, as God offers it, is a free gift. He didn't have to earn it. He didn't have to shake his fist and say, "Aren't I doing enough?" The answer was no. "You can never do enough. I can do enough," says God. "It's my gift to you." He offers us and clothes us in his own righteousness to make us acceptable. You see, the righteousness that will kill us if we remain in our sin is also the very thing that saves us, because we're made, if I can put it like this, we're made fireproof in the presence of God. And God's righteousness is the gospel. It's the good news. There is good news. Paul says in Romans 1, "I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes." Now, how do you get clothed in righteousness? Well, this gift is given to you because it was accomplished through the death of the Lord Jesus Christ on the cross. He came to earth and lived as a man, dressed in our muscles and our flesh and our blood. And yet he was utterly without sin. He went to the cross and he was willingly crucified as a perfect, priceless, atoning sacrifice to pay for the sins that we've done. We just don't deserve it. And that's what makes God's extraordinary kindness grace. Mike Reeves, who's a Christian writer, says this: "The Father, in his great love, sends the Son. And the Son, delighting to do the will of the Father and sharing his Father's love, goes. Indeed, that love and delight make the Son unstoppable. He sets his face to go to Jerusalem, where he will die. He rebukes Peter for suggesting otherwise. He trembles at the thought of it, but lays down his life entirely of his own accord anyway. For he, the Son, desires to be both the high priest and the sacrifice for sin, offering himself to his Father through the Spirit." Well, this was such a powerful truth that in 1517, Luther was famously nailing his 95 theses to the door of the cathedral in Wittenberg, questioning the practices and teachings of the Roman Catholic Church. And these statements began an unstoppable wave of change. For hundreds of years, democratic government, the rule of law, freedom of conscience, civil rights, scientific inquiry, the education of the masses, an understanding of the value and sanctity of human life, to name just a few. And we take those things as our right here in Britain and in Europe, don't we? We can't understand a world where those things aren't for everybody. Well, they weren't once. They came about. I'm aware time's pushing on. I just need to say that if you're not a Christian here this evening, you need to come to an understanding the same as Martin Luther. You need to realize that where you stand is no good, and all of your efforts to be good will never be good. God has to clothe you in his own righteousness, and you must come and bow the knee before him, accepting that his righteousness is everything you need. You have to both let go and embrace. Let go of your understanding and interpretation and embrace God's. His is the only definition that ever counts, because it's the true one. His way corrects you and eventually perfects you. Ask him to change you. Ask him to come into your life. He has no hesitation in sharing himself. I want to close with just Romans 3, verse 21. "But now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it." This is Jesus Christ. "The righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. There is no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God and are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith." Amen.